walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animals. Talking animals. Talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Amy Kite, who mere weeks ago was named Executive Director of Bush Wildlife Sanctuary, a wildlife refuge, hospital, and rehabilitation facility in Jupiter, Florida, where Kite has worked in various capacities since 2004. Bush treats about 4,500 animals annually, from birds to bobcats to gators, aiming to release them or offer a permanent home for those animals unable to be released, and provides environmental education to the 100,000 or so people who visit the sanctuary each year. This job promotion represents just the latest chapter of Kite's lifelong saga of loving and caring for animals. In addition to her array of expanded duties at Bush, Kite and her husband run a pet setting and dog walking business, which, full disclosure, looked after my family's cats and dogs for a few days last summer. We'll hear about Bush Wildlife Sanctuary, what changes or new policies she has in mind to implement, animal stories of one kind or another, and more when I speak with Amy Kite in a moment here on Talking Animals. Later in the show, I'll speak with Brad Myers, a.k.a. the Vagabond Chef, who will be giving a cooking demo showing how to make his popular Mediterranean veggie burger part of a vegan potluck to be held next Thursday, January 25th, at the Safety Harbor Art and Music Center. Meanwhile, let's get to Amy with the reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Amy Kite on Talking Animals. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
No, thank you for having me.
Yeah, so first, congratulations on being named Executive Director of Bush Wildlife Sanctuary. So look forward to discussing the sanctuary and providing a nice introduction for many folks listening who may not be familiar with the facility yet, and hearing about some of your plans for it. But first, let's talk about you and animals before you became top dog at the sanctuary. So now, this sounds like it might be an apocryphal story, but it's been said somewhere or another that you loved animals so much at such a young age that you were helping out at a veterinarian's office at age six. True or not true?
True.
Wow. What were you doing?
Well, full disclosure, like you said earlier,
yes,
I actually, my parents were friends with the veterinarian. They all grew up in the same small town in Ohio, and then all ended up back here in Palm Beach County, where she opened a vet's office. And I had gone into a little restaurant, little strip mall down in Lantana here in Palm Beach County, and they had opened a grooming shop. And I was this little itty-bitty blonde-haired girl, and I went over to the grooming shop, and I said, I want a job. And they pretty much said, oh, aren't you cute, patted me on the head, and sent me on my way, because nobody's going to let a six-year-old come in and help out. And I went to lunch with my dad at this little restaurant, and I was sobbing. I was crying and devastated, and the Ohio State-Michigan game was on. And if you know anything about college football, they are huge rivals. And the veterinarian was sitting there, who is a diehard Buckeye fan. She came over to my dad, and she said, you got to make her be quiet. What is her problem? She's got to stop crying. And he said, she wants a job. She wants to work with animals. She said, tell her to come in on Saturday. She's got a job. Just make her stop crying.
Wow.
True story. Never thought I'd show up. Figured she'll forget about it.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to happen. And my parents said that Saturday morning, I was standing at the edge of their bed like a creepy little kid. Is it ready to go? Or can we go? Can we go? Can we go? He took me in. And I ended up staying there. I stayed there all through elementary school, middle school, high school, through college, all the way up. I think I was 22 when I finally ventured out and did something else. But every Saturday morning, I would go in. And then every summer, every school holiday, I just I loved it. There was nothing else for me.
That's quite a long stint. So every year, did you reenact your noisy, distracting thing before the during the Ohio-Michigan game? But all those years, did it move from the grooming part to the vet part over at some point?
Much everything. I helped out with the boarding and grooming portion. I mean, I was a kid too. I got bored pretty easily, and they were just wonderful with kind of moving me around, letting me learn different things. And when I was six, I mean, I would literally you hold the wall up, and when they're done taking care of an animal in a room, you get to go in and clean it up. And there was, I'll never forget, there was a little holder, and it had alcohol in it. They had the old school mercury thermometers put in the alcohol to keep them sanitary.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a pen holder, and I kept putting all the ballpoint pens in it.
Wow.
And I remember the doctor coming out, and she was so mad because she thought one of the adults was doing it. She said, "Who's ruining all the pens?" You know, and I stood there quivering, thinking, "I'm fired. That's it. I just lost it." You know, and then realized, okay, it's the child. Give her another break, you know, and I kind of learned the hard way to speak, you know, but they let me keep coming, and it was free, and I would do any dirty job they gave me, you know, go pick the poop up in the yard. I was happy to do it. Remember a turtle coming in, they said, make sure it doesn't escape, and so I just sat and watched it. I'm sure it was just to keep me out of their hair.
Yeah.
But I'd do it. I didn't mind.
But that really does speak to a few things, but it really does speak most directly, I guess, to a very precocious passion for animals, and you clearly were not to be denied. And then once you got that opportunity, I mean, you really went for it and learned whatever you could and stayed there, what, 15, 16 years, it sounds like.
Yeah.
And they obviously, even if at times, like, they gave assignments like watching the turtle, like you say, maybe just to get you out of the room for a little bit. On the other hand, they obviously did like what you were doing along the way, because if you're putting pins in where the thermometers go and some other stuff, I mean, other people might have said, okay, you know, this isn't quite working out, and be very nice about it, but send you on your way. And they didn't.
No, they were extremely kind. They yeah. were wonderful to me. I still am in contact to this day with them. A number of the people, the veterinarians and staff who worked there, they're incredibly supportive. I was really, really blessed. I had an opportunity that I don't think many people have gotten in their life to know what they wanted to do and to be surrounded by people who were willing to foster that and to nourish it. And I'm very happy with that and very, you know, unbelievably grateful.
Yeah. Well, it's so interesting, too, because on this show, I've spoken to a number of folks who decided as young kids, maybe around the time that you decided that you were going to go work there, these folks often decided something similar. I'm going to work with animals. Often they plan to be a vet. But then the report often includes that those plans changed or were postponed, often at least, that, hey, turns out being a vet is a little more ambitious undertaking than I thought. And sometimes they detour a little bit just from that. Sometimes they detour for a while from working with animals altogether. But usually they swing back around at some point. But it seems like yours has been like pretty much a straight path.
Most part, I did learn pretty quickly that I, because when I was little, I did want to be a vet, or I thought I wanted to be. And then what I started to notice as I grew a little bit older was the animals, when they came to the vet's office, they weren't always the happiest to see the actual doctor, but they liked the nursing staff. Nursing staff didn't give the injections, do the bad things, you know, necessarily, so to speak. Give all the credit in the word to the vet, but the animals weren't always the happiest. And that's kind of where I started to go more towards the caretaking side of things. And I myself am a certified veterinary technician, so I did kind of more the nursing route. The animals enjoyed seeing them. And my life really kind of took a turn as I got into my early 20s, and I had been there for over 10 years, you know, going 15 years or so. And what I had seen was a lot of the animals that I had grown up with that I almost considered, you know, my own family were getting older. A lot of them were passing away. Mm. And I was at the point where I was in my early 20s, but I was always sad. And that's really where I got into wildlife. Is there was one woman who was a client at the office, and she had this huge, thick chart. She had all kinds of pets herself. So right there, she became my idol.
Sure.
Wanted to be just like her when I grew up and moved out of my parents' home. I wanted everything. And whenever someone would bring in, you know, oh, I found an injured rabbit, or this turtle was hit by a car, they would always call her. And finally, one day, I had to ask, I said, what do you do? Why do they call you? What is it? And she said, well, I run a wildlife hospital, and I never knew that one existed. And she led me to volunteering, and that led me down this path, and it just opened a whole new world of how to work with animals that I never knew existed.
And before we get further into that, Amy, what along the way from when you were that six-year-old that said, hey, I'm going to go work at this place and then stay there 15 or so years, what was the situation at your own house with pets? What sort of role did pets and animals play in your family?
Oh, my parents were very much, and they still are, you can have one dog. And then one cat showed up at the, you know, across the street, a stray cat showed up and you could feed it across the street. And then across the street became the driveway. And then the driveway became the garage. You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know,
constant negotiation.
You know, if you win a goldfish at the fair, that's a really big deal now. You know, I mean, pets were a big responsibility and it was not taken lightly. You didn't go out and bring things home to keep. You know, everything was, you know, so when I did finally move out, I kind of went a little crazy.
Yeah.
I have my own little farm now and I absolutely love it. But that's, you know, you just had maybe one dog and one cat and that was about it. They love animals and they do anything for them, but we definitely didn't have a house that was full of critters.
So it sounds like even when you were younger, before you even moved out on your own and could do whatever you wanted at your own house in terms of animals, sounds like at least some of what was fueling the thing is you had this passion for animals. You probably felt somewhat confined or limited at your own house, like, hey, we got one dog, and if we get lucky, there's a cat, or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it seems like also doing all that work or helping out all that time at the vet's office was like, well, this puts me in contact with gobs and gobs of animals, which is what I want.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, I would pretend they were my own pets, and I was always trying to foster things and bring them home, hoping my parents would fall in love and let me keep them all, and Yeah. I was that kid.
For sure. Yeah. Well, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you're just tuning in, my guest is Amy Kite, who was recently named Executive Director of Bush Wildlife Sanctuary, Wildlife Refuge, Hospital, and Rehabilitation Center in Jupiter, Florida. The facility treats upwards of 4,500 animals annually. If you'd like to ask Amy a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So let's trace the rest of this path that leads us probably not too far down the road to Bush. But so you met this woman, you find out what she does, find out there's a hospital that's designated for treating wildlife. So pick up your story there. What did you go work for her, or what happened next?
Well, I started volunteering.
Yeah.
I was still working at the vet's office. I was in college. I actually did other little odd jobs, you know, like any college kid. I did kind of a little bit of bartending and things of that nature. But I started volunteering at the wildlife hospital. And through that, you know, and this is how I tell a lot of, you know, our staff here has actually gotten their positions is through volunteering and, you know, giving of their time. And one day the person who was supposed to show up didn't show up for work and they kind of abandoned and they offered me a job and I was making, I think it was $5.95 an hour and I thought it was the best thing ever.
Stop your horrible bragging there, Amy. That's yeah.
I thought it was amazing.
Yeah.
You know? And
well, it was probably incidental almost at that point to you, right? Like what you were making, because as we've already learned here, you had such a burning passion to just work with animals, be with animals, that the money was almost secondary, I would guess.
I still lived at home. My parents and I get along great. I didn't care if I lived there forever.
Yeah.
Free. Of course, I'm sure they would have cared.
Right.
You know, life was good. No worries. You know, I was still in college, but I wasn't really loving it. You know, it wasn't a big party or anything like that.
Yeah.
I just wanted to do it. So you gave me a job in wildlife, and it was kind of like, do I still have to do college? I found my job. And,
right.
You know, if it weren't for my father pushing me out the door to get to class, I would have just worked every day at the wildlife hospital, no doubt about it.
But I assume the college thing kind of at least partly put you in the direction of getting your vet tech training, right? Or is that sort of a separate deal?
I went back to school again.
Oh, okay.
I went back to school. Once I really figured out what I thought would be more beneficial to the wildlife, I went back to school in my early 30s and I did the vet tech degree.
Oh, I see. Okay, so there was that gap.
That's when I finally figured college out.
I got you. Yeah, well, sometimes that's what you need is like, okay, now I have a real motivation. Now I'm eager to get to class versus
exactly.
Like, ugh, another class.
It took me a little while to figure out the true value of a formal education. So.
But it sounds like pretty much, though, the through line from really being that little kid up through, well, you know, then and now even, was like the goal was always to be doing something at least that involved working with or caring for animals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's all I know. It's truthfully all I know.
But it's all you wanted to know, it really sounds like, too, if I follow you. Yeah.
It is. Yeah, it really is. There was never any other, idea in my mind as to what I was going to do.
So when did you then first hear about or go to Bush Wildlife Sanctuary?
Well, the place I was volunteering at was a small sanctuary that no longer exists called Ocean Impact Foundation. It used to be located on the grounds of Palm Beach County Animal Care and Control.
Okay.
And a very small facility, and Bush Wildlife was located up in Jupiter.
Yeah.
And much larger facility, dealt with larger animals. We did kind of smaller animals on a smaller scale. So anytime that Ocean Impact Foundation received something that we didn't have the facility to handle, that needed, more room, needed more specialized care, it was transferred to Bush Wildlife. And so during that time is when I became acquainted with Bush Wildlife and started coming up here, whether it be transporting animals or we'd work different events together. And that's how I became acquainted.
So, I described it in preparing to introduce you as a wildlife refuge, hospital, and rehabilitation facility. Does that cover it, or how? You probably have a better, more succinct description.
The only thing that I would add to it is an educational facility.
Okay, yeah.
We basically have two goals. One is to be a wildlife hospital. So we take in about 4,500 patients annually with the goal of returning them to the wild, and we focus on native Florida wildlife. Of course, not all of those animals get back out in the wild again. As with any hospital, unfortunately, you have some patients that are too badly injured or too sick, and they just don't make it. So we do offer refuge to animals that can't go back in the wild, and we have them here for education purposes, whether it be for exhibit or for educational presentations. And the reason we do that is what we started to notice is as the patients come into us, almost 90% of the cases that we see here at Bush Wildlife are human-related injury or illness. So we get a lot of animals that are hit by cars, tangled in fishing line, illegal gunshot wounds, electrocutions, attacked by people's pets, kept illegally as pets, and even things that aren't necessarily as dramatic, so to speak, where it's intentional, is things like runoff from fertilizers going into our water streams and causing things like botulism, diseases that are spread through communal areas like bird feeders. So we really feel that, the humanitarian effort we do as a hospital also needs to be paired with educating the public so that hopefully they learn about these animals and how to help prevent some of these injuries so that we don't see as many patients coming through the door.
What form does that educational side take? Is it just that when someone comes to visit and kind of look around the sanctuary, or are there structured classes or programs as well, or how does that?
Well, we do a few things. We are open to the public Monday through Saturday from 10 to 4:30, where people can come enjoy the sanctuary. We run strictly on donations, so we don't charge a fee. You can just come and enjoy and leave whatever you can to keep the doors open. We do offer public programs Monday through Friday at 3 p.m. and Saturdays at 11 and 2. And then we also have private groups, organized groups that can set up to come to the sanctuary with our education department. There is a suggested donation that goes along with that, and they will do a guided tour with them and a private presentation, where they bring out a variety of animals, and they talk to them about how the animals got here, their environment, they share with them how to help. We can also go out into the community and do presentations, whether it be exhibits, programs. We've gone into schools. We've gone into nursing homes, different environmental agencies, and done programs. We've even gone to the point where we work with Jack Hanna. We work with Julie Scardina. We work with Jeff Corwin, and we've gone on the road with them. Our animals have gone to David Letterman, Jay Leno, Today Show, Good Morning America. So kind of going a more entertainment route, though, but to really try to reach out to people who don't seek out education of environmental nature.
So it's like makes it easy for people who, as you say, wouldn't maybe ordinarily seek it out. But if you bring it to them or make it very accessible, they will then have an opportunity to learn some of the important things that you guys are really trying to impart to them about wildlife.
Yeah, make it a little bit more palatable, kind of pique their interest. Maybe they'll see it through that kind of media and go, wow, what a beautiful bobcat. And through that, then hopefully they'll search out Bush Wildlife Sanctuary and then come visit us or facilities in their area that are similar. And through that one species, maybe learn about a lot of other species as well.
And again, you mentioned this when you're sort of giving your description of the facility, but the animals that you treat there are Florida-specific species, correct?
That is our goal.
Okay. Sounds like there's exceptions.
We're not going to turn anything away.
Okay.
For instance, here recently over the Christmas holiday, we had a call come in about a kinkajou, which is actually kind of a cousin of a raccoon, live in South America. Some people do try to keep them as pets, was loose in a garbage can in a Sunoco gas station here locally.
Wow.
Believe it or not. Yeah. Right in Jupiter Farms, just not too far from where we're located. And we went out, we tried to find the animal because, one, it's not native. They can do damage to our environment. But also, you know, the animal doesn't have what it takes to sustain life. And we don't want anything bad to happen to that animal or for it to fall into the wrong hands, whether the animal were to get injured or for public safety issues also. We weren't able to find it, but a member of the public was able to find it and actually got it contained and brought it to us. Just because it's not native, I'm not going to tell them, get out of here, take the animal, because then I don't know what's going to happen to it, and I don't want it to fall into the wrong hands and someone to get hurt or for the animal to suffer. So we currently have the animal. It's been examined by our medical staff, and we are working with other facilities that handle exotic animals to see if we can place that so that it will have a good quality of life and also be used for education purposes to teach people about kinkajous in their native habitat, why you shouldn't have them as a pet, things of that nature.
And is it clear to you, Amy, that the way and where the animal was found, that it had been someone's pet that just kind of escaped?
That's the best we can assume, whether it escaped, whether they set it loose.
Right, okay.
If you do legally own one of these animals and you can get a permit for them, you have to go through the state of Florida. And if the animal does go missing, the very first thing you have to do is notify the state that the animal has gone missing.
Yeah.
And no report was ever made, so we can either assume that, you know, they either owned it illegally or they really just don't want to get in trouble. No one has stepped forward to claim the animal, so whether it escaped or they just didn't want it anymore and they dumped it, I can't imagine it made it over by from South America all by itself.
Yeah, seems unlikely. Yeah,
it seemed to understand what a kennel was. It understand the food source we were giving it. You know, definitely was not behaving like a true wild kinkajou would.
Let me ask you this, because one of our emailers had done a couple different Facebook posts, and I did one this morning that showed you with the gator that was clearly being treated.
Crocodile.
Sorry. And so this emailer made the same mistake I just made, but said, "Hey, can you ask your guest what the alligator or crocodile, as we know?" No, in the Facebook picture was having duns. What was the treatment or what was going on with that animal?
That picture is actually a couple of years old. What had happened was is they thought it was an alligator actually as well. And very large. That animal was almost 13 feet long and it had ended up in a residential neighborhood and was causing a little bit of havoc. So the state of Florida actually licensed trappers to go out to remove these animals if they feel there's a safety threat. And so this particular trapper had gone out thinking he was going to catch a alligator and ended up catching a crocodile, which American crocodiles are an endangered species here in the United States. And what had happened was is he didn't realize it either. And so when he cast out a very large hook and the crocodile grabbed it and he swallowed the hook. And because we are dealing with an endangered species, this animal was tagged. It was from down towards the Florida Keys, right on the end there, Miami and the Florida Keys. So the crocodile was brought into captivity and was brought to Bush Wildlife Sanctuary. And what we were doing was we were actually scoping the animal using a little camera to go down the throat. We had it sedated, and we were actually using a little scope to go down to find the hook so that we could dislodge it, causing the least amount of damage we can, and remove the hook so that the animal could be then woken up and released back out into the wild where he originally came from.
Not to turn this into a bit of a bummer, but if it had turned out that that was a gator that everybody thought it was instead of an endangered American crocodile, would that animal have met a not-so-good fate with the trapper and with the huge volume of gators that, we...
At that size and because of where it was located, most likely that would have been one that would not have been relocated.
Yeah.
There's estimated to be over 1 million alligators in the state of Florida, and there's only about 2,000 American crocodiles left in the wild.
And at the moment, how many gators and or crocs do you have at Bush, at the sanctuary?
Right now, we've got just two large ones on our exhibit, and then I've got one smaller crocodile that we use for education, and I probably have about a dozen smaller alligators of varying sizes that we use for education.
Gotcha. Again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Amy Kite, the new executive director of Bush Wildlife Sanctuary. But she's worked at this wildlife refuge, hospital, rehabilitation center, and educational center, I guess, since 2004. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing DJ. at WMNF.org or texting 813-433-0885. It seems like as a word heard between the gator that turned out to be a croc and the kinkajou, pretty much within reason, it sounds like if somebody calls you or brings you an animal, you respond.
We do the very best that we can. If somebody does call us and it's an animal that we don't normally handle, you know, for instance, somebody has a pet domestic rabbit or a pet cockatoo, we will try to direct them towards another agency that is specifically designed for taking care of that type of animal. But if someone walks in the door with it, you know, the goal is not to turn any animal away. You know, we don't want the animal to suffer, you know, regardless of what it is. We'll try to find the best proper placement for it when we can.
A few months ago, I'm not sure how this happened, but very tiny, there might have been more than one, but we only saw one ultimately. Baby rabbit ended up kind of near our doorstep. And so we brought it over to Bush, and I think it was just so tiny and away from its mom, whatever, that I just didn't have a good chance to make it. But when I went over there, people were very nice and took the rabbit, and I guess they obviously tried to do what they could. But I also imagine at the time, must be countless experiences like that, not necessarily with a baby rabbit, but I mean just with something or another that people are bringing in, just given the nature of the area and all the different critters that are around.
Well, for instance, right after Hurricane Irma, you know, within the 3 days after Irma had passed, we received well over 100 baby squirrels. And that's because it was right in the middle of baby squirrel season. So with all the wind we had, all the down branches, you know, as people were finally getting out of their homes and going out and assessing damage and trying to clean up their yards, they were just finding baby squirrels all over the place. And under normal circumstances, we would definitely try to reunite them with mom, leave them alone, make a makeshift nest, let's give them a chance. But because there was so much destruction, you know, with the trees and everything involved, we don't know also, was mom hurt in the storm? You know, they were just flooding into us, and it was absolute chaos.
Yeah, no, it sounds overwhelming. And then again, when we're in the midst of it now, or I guess it's going to become even more so in the next year or two, but also I would imagine when there's a significant cold snap, that must alter kind of what happens or what you guys need to do, or at least advising people of what to do.
It does. Majority of our native Florida wildlife is really good at handling it. They all have special adaptations that will take care of it. Here at the sanctuary, what we'll start to notice is a difference in the influx of exotic species that come in. Like, for instance, the last cold snap we had a week or two back, you noticed there was a lot of talk about iguanas falling out of trees,
yeah,
things of that nature. And those are the species that aren't designed to live here, that aren't supposed to be here, and they don't have the adaptations to handle the cold snap. And those are the ones you start to hear more about and actually see showing up, because they don't, you know, they don't do what they need to do to take care of themselves.
Sure. Well, let's get a caller involved. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Amy Kite.
Yeah, hey, I just wanted to thank you, and I don't know if you've contextualized the full goodness of what you're doing, but the fact is that our species, the human species in Florida, we've just stolen the native intact ecological systems away from their original inhabitants. Most of these are helpless, sweet little animals like ground tortoises and squirrels and blue jays and cardinals, etc. And we've paved over their homes. We've killed them. We've poisoned them. We've trapped them. Our dogs chase them and kill them. Cats kill the birds. And then people call them varmints and critters, and they run over them in their cars, sometimes deliberately. And then when the few remnant animals that have managed to survive the totally unnatural, horrendous urbanized grids that we've created, just imagine what it's like for these animals to try and cross a street or get to a water supply. And when they show up, we look at them and go, wow. And then we have to bring them to a refuge. And what you're doing is like a Noah's Ark situation. You're also showing true compassion and empathy. You're a voice for the voiceless. You're a home for the homeless. I just want everybody to really look at our species and see how we steal away the habitats and homes and lives and cultures of all these other animals, many of whom are innocent, sweet things. And then it's left to people like yourselves, not subsidized by government, not helped in many ways, to try and save the few who show up as just castaways in the human environment.
Wow. Okay. Well, thanks for that, Amy. Wow. I don't know if you want to respond to that or just sort of to breathe that in for a moment. And
I've got tears in my eyes, that's for sure. I greatly appreciate that. That is is very kind, and it's a tough thing. It's a very tough thing, you know. I would love to see, and I know it's not going to happen, and we jokingly refer to it as rainbows and unicorns land, where we could put ourselves out of business, where there would be no more need for, you know, everybody could coexist in a beautiful rainbow and unicorn world, and the animals were safe, and the humans were happy, and, you know, this Snow White fairy tale, if you will, and that's just not the reality. And oftentimes we get phone calls that people who just want you to solve their problem of an animal in their yard, or it's pecking at their window, and we try to advocate coexisting and problem solving and making everybody happy, and sometimes you get hung up on, and sometimes you teach, and so it is really wonderful. It's a wonderful compliment, and I greatly appreciate that. And
yeah. Thank you very much, caller. And again, thanks for what you're doing. And again, you've been there since 2004. I guess a couple of questions. What most significant ways, I guess, has Bush Wildlife Sanctuary changed in your 13, 14 years there?
Well, the biggest thing to me that I personally feel a lot of pride about, and I think a lot of facilities, whether it be zoological societies, nature centers, just anybody really who's dealing with wild animals, I feel like it's evolved. And I really love it. It makes me so happy that I stumble over my words, obviously, is that we really view animals differently. When I first started doing this, and even in my own head, you know, when it came to wildlife, there was a lot of focus on just make sure the animal doesn't escape. And safety is still a huge factor, and we're all constantly double-checking, triple-checking safety hallways, locking enclosures, making sure that everybody has proper communication with each other, that everybody's trained properly, that all the enclosures are checked on a daily basis to make sure that the animals are safe and that they're not going to escape, because we are dealing with wild animals. But what wasn't taken as much into consideration, you know, 13 years ago when I started, was really making it enjoyable for the animals. It was kind of just build a box, keep them contained, and you're good to go. Wow. And what we've really tried to do here at Bush Wildlife Sanctuary is with each enclosure that we build and we work on, is we try to make it nicer, more enriching for the animals, you know, green grass for them to walk on, flowing water for them to not only drink, but for them to play in. We try to do enrichment things, whether it be adding scents to their yard, put their food out for them to forage, different platforms, just giving them a cardboard box. They love to tear them up, hide their food in it, let them play with it. Some of these animals all of our animals are here because they can't go back out into the wild. There's some reason, whether they became too used to people being kept as a pet, whether they're blind in one eye, they sustained an old wing injury, whatever it may be. And it really is our responsibility as caretakers to make their life better for them. And that's the biggest thing that I've seen, is the philosophy has changed. It's evolved to a point where you try to encompass an overall picture of what this animal's life is going to be. And it's not about the human aspect of it, but it's really about what the animal needs emotionally, physically, mentally, and how you accomplish all of those things. And also that then has carried over into rehab. And we really look at when they come in as a rehab patient, they don't need loud music playing. They don't need to hear humans talking. They don't need to see humans. All of that has to be kept to a minimum, so when you release them, they're going to do better. And there's been so much more training that's evolved out of these concepts that it just makes me so proud to be in the industry.
Well, it's really interesting because it sounds like a seismic shift, at least over, say, the 13 years that you've been there, in the philosophy, the philosophical underpinning of caring for those animals and how their enclosures work and how they're fed and a kind of enrichment. So to me, you're in a really interesting position of having worked there for 13 years, but now you're in a brand new job of sort of top leadership. I'm going to guess you have some kind of list, at least in your head, if not actually written down, of things you'd nonetheless like to change or improve about the facility.
Definitely. And it's on many different levels. You know, everything from there's certain enclosures here that I definitely want to work on. You know, we kind of each year pick an enclosure and try to redo it and remodel it and make it better. to other things. Just we hear all the time at the sanctuary, people will say, you know, I never knew you guys were there. And maybe it's because they just found that baby bunny and they all of a sudden needed help. Or they're just not somebody who goes to nature center type environmental education facilities often. And that blows my mind because we've been located here for over 20 years. You know, how did you not know we existed? So that's one of my big things is I want everybody to know we exist.
Yeah.
You know, I want everybody to know that there is help for wildlife if you find it. It's not a, oh, darn it, you know, I wish there was some place. There are places, not just here in Palm Beach County, not just Bush Wildlife Sanctuary, but wherever you live, you can find places also. And we'll be happy to try to connect people with proper facilities. So that's a big one for me is just not only getting the word out about the Bush Wildlife Sanctuary, but about wildlife rehab and resources that are available to everybody and to all animals that need help. As far as the sanctuary goes, we need, you know, a new crocodile and alligator habitat. That's kind of big on this year to start fundraising for because we don't get government funding, so we fundraise through private donations and grants. And also, we're working on putting in a new walkway to our wildlife hospital. We have a beautiful wildlife hospital through grant through the Bernice Barber Foundation, but we need to put a walkway in so that we can expedite the care the animals get going back there. And we have this wonderful building that's been sitting on our property that we're going to be remodeling to make an indoor educational facility. We'll have a wet lab and a classroom and interactive displays so that we can really drive home all of the ideas that we have about how to keep wildlife safe, how to coexist with wildlife, how to help your environment. So all of this together is all hopefully going to be taking shape within the next year here at Bush Wildlife Sanctuary.
Well, those are some very ambitious plans for sure. And here's just a question for somebody who lives nearby and especially when people have been visiting from out of town, this has come up on the wrong end of it once or twice. I'm sure there's a very good reason for it, but why is Bush Wildlife Sanctuary not open on Sunday?
You know, that's been asked back and forth a million times.
Yeah, sorry to make a million in one.
No, it's fine. Don't worry about it. And we've discussed it, but it is really kind of nice for our animals to just get a day off.
Yeah, no, I totally get that. I just selfishly, I guess, and from the standpoint of a lot of people, I'd say, why can't they have Monday off? Just because I'm thinking there's a lot of people, you know, if you're talking about getting the word out and getting more people to come, a lot of people, obviously more readily can come on a weekend day, and you are open, of course, on Saturday. But if there are another weekend,
to be full disclosure, full transparency on it.
Okay.
On Mondays, when children are in school and when other groups are in, and we do private groups,
yeah,
we actually bring in more as far as funding to go to the animals than we do through the donation boxes on a Sunday.
Okay. Well, that's interesting.
So, yeah, believe it or not. So if we've got school groups that contact us or scout groups or, you know, any other kind of organized group, which we actually have a fee that we charge for those based on per person. So if they want to come on a Monday and we were closed and we turned that kind of income away, we can actually make more of that on a Monday than we normally pull out of a donation box.
Okay.
So
well, that's,
for
yeah,
us, it comes down to simple finances. And could we open on Sundays? And then we now, you know, that we could, and we've discussed it before, but for right now, for the quality of life for our animals, it just is a nice for them to have a day where they can just relax, be animals. If they don't want to come out into the yard, they just want to sit and chill, just like all of us. It's a day of decompression.
Sure. Well, I totally get that. I just was trying to see if there was some way to steer it towards a different day of decompression. But there's so many variables that, especially now that you're running the show, that you have to kind of really keep in mind. I'm glad I asked, and I'm glad I got that answer, because we have wondered over a number of years and just figured, okay, there's got to be a good reason, because otherwise it seems like, again, it's counterintuitive, I guess, as it turns out, to what the reality is, but that there would be more visitors or more potential visitors just because it is a weekend day and people aren't at work as much, aren't at school as much, etc. But it sounds like on a donation level, which is obviously a key criteria, it doesn't actually work that way. So.
And if somebody wanted to schedule something, like sometimes we will open up for a special event on a Sunday or a birthday party where someone makes a specified donation, we could always do that. If somebody wanted to bring their family on a Sunday and have an educator meet them here and do like a behind-the-scenes tour, we're more than happy to do that. We just work out with you a donation amount, and then we have someone meet you, and you can have the place to yourself.
Well, we'll keep that in mind next time we have people in town and can only go on a Sunday. We'll say, all right, we'll arrange this with Amy in advance and have a big...
You've got an in.
All right, cool. So I'm going to read you one email that just came in, and we're just otherwise sort of at the end of our time, Amy. But this emailer says, sorry, I joined your show late. I just wanted to say the woman on your show is awesome, all caps, with an exclamation mark. Please thank her for all she does. It is very much appreciated. Also, can you let us know her name again along with her Twitter name? So her name is Amy Kight. It's K-I-G-H-T. She's from now the executive director of the Bush Wildlife Sanctuary. The website is Bush, B-U-S-C-H, wildlife.org. And I don't know, are you on Twitter, Amy?
I am not on Twitter.
Okay.
I am on Facebook.
Yeah.
Amy J. Kight. And then my Instagram is our pet sitting company. So.
Oh, right, which I should have mentioned more. I at least. So if you want to say that name, you can now that we're
sure,
talking about
it. It's Lulu's Zoo. So Lulus Zoo Pet Sitting is our pet sitting company. And that's my Instagram. It's all animals. You might see a picture of my husband because I'm the one working the camera, but that's about it on there. I'm not terribly social media savvy, but the sanctuary does have our own Facebook page, Bush Wildlife Sanctuary, and our own Instagram, which is Bush Wildlife Sanctuary.
Cool.
Never gotten the Twitter. I need to work on that.
Well, there you go. See, so there's all kinds of things that have come out of today's show. So, Amy, thank you so much for making the time to join us on Talking Animals, and good luck with the new job, and we'll be over to visit, probably not on a Sunday, but at some point soon, and to say hello and see all the great improvements that you'll be putting in. So thanks again.
Awesome. Thank you. Have a good one.
All right. Thanks. You too.
Bye.
In a few moments, I'll speak with Brad Myers, the Vagabond chef, who will deliver a demonstration of how to make his renowned Mediterranean veggie burger at the Safety Harbor Art and Music Center next Thursday, January 25th, at an event also designed to be a vegan potluck. Right now, it's time to step into the Comedy Corner, where we'll be hearing a piece by Jackie Cation, whom we're big fans of here. She tends to open Maria Bamford's shows across the country, but is a top-notch comic in her own right. This is Jackie Cation on Talking Animals.
Last Christmas when I was here, I got an opportunity, a golden opportunity, to do a town last minute in North Dakota. A very small town in North Dakota. But my brother and sister both live here in Minneapolis, and I'd already promised my brother that I would dog sit for him. So I had to bring the dog with me to North Dakota to the show. And this town was enormously small, and it was small enough that they were excited to see the dog. That's a new dog. Where'd you get that dog? That's a nice looking dog. What kind of dog is that? It's a pound dog? I don't know. It's just a dog. And I had the dog with me in the bar where the show was happening, because you could. And the dog is wandering around meeting everybody because it's a dog. And it's a great dog, Sparky the dog. There he is, wandering around. And he licks this guy. He just, because he's a dog. And the guy looks at me and he goes, he just kissed me. That's a town needs more women. Or more dogs. Here's the weird thing, is I love dogs, I've always wanted a dog, I think they're great, but the weird thing about LA, it's gotta be happening here too, the creepy, I'm going to spend thousands of dollars to keep my animal alive long after the time when the dog should be, wow, new dog, how about that? When I was a kid, when your dog got old and sick, you sadly, put the dog down so that the dog could go away and be happy somewhere else. Now, we're gonna keep the dog. We're keeping the dog. In LA, I swear, some woman paid $3,000, friend of mine, paid $3,000 to replace the hip on her dog. You know what, 3,000 new dogs. How about that? That's $3,000. And it didn't work. So now her dog is still wandering around like Captain Pike on like a little scooter thing, you know? It's just... And if the dog can't run around, it's not like the dog is like Stephen Hawking. You know, it's not going to write the great American novel. It's not going to happen. It's a dog. And I love animals. I genuinely do. It sounds like I'm an ass, but... And I am, I suppose.
Well, that was Jackie Cation with a piece called New Dog, taken from her album Circus People. Okay, on to the Vagabond Chef and the veggie burger demo and potluck, vegan potluck in store next Thursday at the Safety Harbor Art and Music Center. This is Brad Myers on Talking Animals. Good morning, Brad.
Hey, how you doing, Duncan?
Good. Thanks for joining me today on Talking Animals. So first, let's find out, how did you come by your handle, the Vagabond Chef?
That's funny. That just sort of happened one day. It was kind of a whim, and it stuck. People liked it.
Yeah.
I'm usually not that great at naming things, but that one caught on.
Right, and that reflects that you are a vegan chef, that you teach vegan-related and veg-related cooking classes.
I kind of thought that I kind of just do my own thing, so
yeah,
it felt like a good name.
All right, so with that in mind, you've done these demos, as I understand it, a few times. Let me ask you,
actually,
perhaps...
For quite a while now, for about 5 years, I've been doing cooking classes around town. Nature's Food Patch is a big spot for me, and also throughout the library system. I've kind of been there. I'm doing a few in Hillsboro and Pinellas Libraries.
Cool. So let me ask you what may be a critical question, at least for next week's demo. What makes your Mediterranean veggie burger so popular?
Man, it's just really delicious.
Okay. Well, that's a good place to start. What makes it so delicious, do you think?
You know, it's just a perfect combination of whole food ingredients that I don't want to give away all the secrets, because actually the thing about it is that it's really simple. And at the potluck coming up, I'm going to demonstrate one of these veggie burgers. I'm actually going to make one for everybody and do it with a nice little sauce and a little open face on some pita. And I'm going to give out some handouts that have the basic formula and several variations on that formula. It's just really, really easy and really delicious. I've actually had this veggie burger. I've put it into a few restaurants in my time, in a couple different places.
Cool. So let's talk a little bit more about the details of the demo itself. So it's next Thursday, January 25th, at the Safety Harbor Art and Music Center.
Yeah, and that place is really an amazing nonprofit art and music place. There's classes, there's performances, there's all kinds of just incredible stuff. You can find them at shamc.org. That's shamc.org.
Right, and so you can get the lowdown on them, and then the lowdown on the cooking demo / vegan potluck, I guess you can get a few places there, as well as, I think I saw it on a Facebook page of yours.
Yeah, if you go to my Facebook page, just Vegabond Chef, it's Vegabond, Vegabond Chef, and it's the very most recent post, and you can click on that and figure out everything that you need to do to come join us. There's only a few spots left, so hopefully, I'm pretty positive it'll fill up. So hopefully, if you're listening to this right now, you can sign up right away.
Don't ponder this too long, or the opportunity may be gone. Although, if I understand this correctly, you do these, if not monthly, fairly regularly. So if someone can't catch the one on the 25th for one reason or another, there will be other opportunities.
Yeah, we're definitely going to be doing this on a monthly basis.
Yeah, but this is the first time, on the other hand, I think, that in addition to the demo, which you have done before, this also is going to be a vegan potluck, which I think is the first time, right?
Yeah, that's it. It's kind of an interesting concept we came up with, because, you know, I always do these demos and then everybody gets to have a little taste.
Nice.
Well, now we've set it up so we can have a whole feast, and we're going to put out a long table, and everybody's hopefully going to bring some sort of vegan side dish, or, you know, you can bring even an entree or anything you want, fresh fruit or salad. Just
sounds
something
great.
To add to the pot, and we're just going to have a giant feast.
That sounds awesome. So great. We're just almost at the end of our time here, Brad, but let me just ask you quickly, because you say you're not that good at coming up with names, but I think you operate under yet another alias in your musical side. So why don't we find out just for a moment or so about that?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I also do a one-man band kids act for kids of pretty much any age will enjoy it, but mostly up to like 6 or so. And I play like 7 instruments: violin, mandolin, flute, guitar, drum, piano, some of them simultaneously. And we do a bunch of familiar sing-alongs and high-energy original music. And anything, I'm all over the library system with that and a bunch of different event spaces, including Shamsi, at least twice a month there now.
And so could people kind of go to that same Facebook page to find out more about that, or is there a link there?
They can actually go to Mr. Brad's Music.
Okay, Mr. Brad's Music.
For that.
Cool. Yep. Okay, Brad, well, I'm afraid we have reached about the end of the show here, so we are out of time, but good luck next Thursday, and we'll keep an eye out for Mr. Brad's performances around town, and thanks so much for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Thanks, Duncan. Thanks for having me.
You bet. We have indeed just about reached the end of Talking Animals. Coming up, it's Rob Loray and Radioactivity kicking off a three-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including in the new hour midpoint with Nola Lalay. Then at 1 p.m., John Gilmore presides over executive session. And meanwhile, next week on Talking Animals, my guest will be Jody Whitaker, campaign director for Chicago Alliance for Animals. She's spearheading the organization's campaign to ban horse carriages in Chicago. So hope you'll join us for that. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WMNF, Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and beyond. Community conscious radio, handpicked music and news. Thanks for listening. Speak with you next Wednesday at 10 a.m. on Talking Animals. NPR News headlines coming up presently, and then Rob Loray and Radioactivity. Thanks so much.